From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Mike Waters, and this is Options.
Now, a very interesting thing that can be done with a nightmare is, it's rather difficult to get into, but with practice, you can. And that is, when you're in a nightmare, to try to become aware in the dream itself, in the nightmare itself, that this is a dream. I am in my own dream. It's like my consciousness observing another part of my own consciousness. So that the lion that is pursuing me, or the men with knives that are pursuing me, or the tidal wave that is about to overtake me, instead of running away or waking myself up, I can turn around to it and say, I am a dream body, and you're a dream tiger, and I can't be hurt, and you can't be hurt. So instead of running away, I'm going to sit down and have a chat with you.
Psychologist and author Anne Faraday. Dr. Faraday was interviewed by Tom Regan of public station WMRA in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Their subject? A world that we are supposed to visit on an average of 6 times an evening. The world of dreams. Tom Regan wanted to know first about Dr. Faraday's recent publications.
These are your two books, The Dream Game and Dream Power. Did the Dream Game come out first?
No, Dream Power came first.
Dream Power.
Dream Power is slightly more theoretical, slightly more academic. In fact, I wrote The Dream Game in response to people who said, you know, your Dream Power turned me on to dreams, but it is perhaps just a little advanced. Would you please write a book starting at the very beginning with the dream I had last night, and that is The Dream Game.
All right. You mentioned that you did your PhD work in this field. What prompted you to write these books? Did you feel you have a message that you wanted to convey to people to improve their lives? Or
yes, I did have a message to convey to people, and it really started in childhood when I had nightmares of being pursued and attacked, and nobody could help me with the dreams. My parents were good people, but they didn't know what to do with dreams, and they just sent me back to sleep saying, "It's just a dream, dear. Forget it." But I couldn't forget those dreams. They were so real. And I think it, you know, my interest started then. And I thought, when I grow up, I'm going to know what dreams mean so that parents can learn what dreams mean and can help their children deal with nightmares and dreams. So it really started way, way back. And obviously the thing to do was do a psychology degree. And then I did my PhD in the laboratory. Monitoring the eye movements and collecting dreams from a very large sample of people. And Dream Power, my first book, came out of my research.
What is a dream?
A dream is basically a replay in depth of one's day. Let me explain that. It seems to me that we go around our day living on a kind of head trip. We're so busy, we rush around, we say hello to people, goodbye, we rush into situations. We never stop, really, to feel into people or into situations or the very sort of subtle things that are going on in our lives. And I like to call a dream a thought of the heart. That's a very unscientific term, but it just sums up for me what a dream is, as distinct from a thought of the head. And what a dream does at night, really, is to throw up all the unfinished business of the day. All the feelings, vibes, impressions that we've missed out on during the day because we were too busy or perhaps too unwilling to notice them. A dream is really like a sixth sense. It's like a detective gathering all the information so that we can, you know, have enough information to make decisions on.
Okay, we were talking earlier and I mentioned something about dreaming as a way that we can subconsciously work out anxieties that perhaps we picked up consciously during the day.
Not really, no. A dream throws up unfinished business. An example would be, for instance, the woman who called me up and she said, I have this recurring dream of burying my family. And I love them very dearly. What does this dream mean? Well, the point is that with her head, with her conscious mind, she was not aware of all the resentful feelings that were building up inside her. But her dream came along and said, look, lady, get in touch with these feelings. Otherwise, you'll explode. Aware of to consciousness. A dream does not come to tell us what we know already.
A lot of people are walking around today saying that they don't know what's the matter with them or what's the matter with me, and they tell me that they never dream. Is this true? Do some people just dream all the time profusely and others don't?
No. Many people are better recallers of dreams, but we all in fact dream 5 or 6 times every single night of normal sleep. As you probably know, when we fall asleep, we go very quickly into deep sleep, from light sleep into deep sleep, and then after about an hour, we come back up into light sleep. And this cycle of light and deep sleep goes on throughout the night. And we dream in our periods of light sleep. And we have about 6 periods of light sleep during the night, and these periods of light sleep get longer as morning approaches, so that we, in fact, have our longest, most vivid dream in the morning.
This would explain why I dream after I turn off my alarm clock and then go back to sleep again.
Oh, alarm clocks are terrible things. if you're interested in collecting dreams, if you're interested in recording and recalling your dreams, don't use an alarm clock. An alarm clock cuts right across. It's like sort of breaking you. It's taking you from one state of consciousness into another. An alarm clock that perhaps plays a little music first and wakes you up gently is a very good thing, because then you can lie in bed gradually waking up and then collect your dream.
What would be the best way to go about keeping a dream diary?
Just lie in bed perhaps for a moment when you wake up with the dream. Just turn it over perhaps a few seconds just to collect yourself. And then reach out very gently for your pencil and paper and write the dream down. If you do not write it down immediately, it does disappear. In the morning, don't try to have breakfast first or shave or run around. The dream will be gone in the meantime. So write it down. Also, when you've got your pencil and paper there at night, all ready for your dreams, you date your paper. You put the date at the top. And this is important because in looking back over your dreams, you might sort of get a meaning. Suppose there's one dream you can't understand, or a few dreams you can't understand, and then comes a dream that you do understand, and it's got a recurring symbol in it. You can then turn back to an old dream and say, ah, now I can understand that one in light of a later dream. And you will often find that it during the day of these dreams that have similar themes or similar symbols in them, that they have been triggered by a similar situation in us. And this is very interesting from the point of view of knowing what causes these dreams to arise in us during the day. So what we also do, as well as writing the dream down, is also after it, in the morning, just to make a small note of the previous day's events as a sort of landmark, so that when I look back, I can say, ah, maybe that triggered my dream.
All right, how can we understand the meaning of our dreams?
That's a good question. When I say that a dream is a replay in depth of one's day, many people don't understand this because they say, this dream I had last night was so bizarre, it didn't have anything to do with my day at all. For instance, I was being chased down the street by a tiger, and there aren't any tigers in my life. Or there was this tidal wave that was coming to overwhelm me, and I wasn't even at the beach yesterday. So how can the dream be replaying my day in depth? Well, the point is, in the first place, the dream is throwing up feelings that we've missed about ourselves and other people during the day. The other thing is that it plays back to us these feelings in picture language, in symbols. And to understand these symbols, we have what we consider a very simple 3-stage method of getting at what the symbols in dreams mean. Let's suppose you dream of snakes. Many people dream of snakes. Now, on our level one, this is the first thing you do. You've got your dream, you've got your snakes there. You say, what does this dream mean? On our level one, we say, could the dream be a warning, a very simple warning, about a real snake in your life? And where we live, which is in Central America, when we have dreams about snakes, we don't sort of go into the symbolism of the snake until we have looked in the kitchen, in the bathroom, in the bed, and everywhere. Because what happens to us during the day is that we're picking up at a sort of gut level vibes and impressions, little signals that we've been too busy to catch. So if I dream of a snake in Costa Rica, I ask myself, did I detect subliminally at gut level a snake during the day? If you dream of losing your purse, do not go into the symbolism of what that means until you have checked that your purse is not lost, okay? That's the simplest level. If you cannot find a meaning here, you go to level two of interpretation and you ask yourself, what does snake mean to me? And I don't care what it means to anybody else or what it means to any psychoanalyst or any expert. Interpretation of this symbol is mine. I made the snake and only I know what that means. So then, having found out what a snake is, to me it's a slippery, horrible, poisonous creature. I then look around my external world and ask, could this snake be representing to me somebody in my life at the moment? Could it be my husband, a colleague, my boss, a friend, has behaved perhaps like a snake in the grass during the day? So level two is that you look out into your world for the meaning of your dream symbol. If you can't find anything there, then you have to come to level three of interpretation and say, that snake must be a part of myself. In some way, I behave like a snake in the grass during the day, and it's very instructive to look into oneself to discover these things.
How can we know the correct interpretation of our dreams?
There's no such thing as the correct interpretation of a dream. I think that the psychoanalysts of the various schools of psychology, for instance, the Freudians, the Jungians, and other people have done us a great disservice by trying to fit dream symbols or dream meanings into a theory. You cannot do this. We say that you get to the correct interpretation of a dream or the effective interpretation of a dream when it makes sense to you in terms of your present life situation, when it tells you something new, when you get an aha feeling and it moves you to change your life constructively in some way. So don't take any notice of what a so-called expert tells you about your dream unless it does this for you, unless it makes sense to you.
I often dream of being chased, and I can't get away, and whatever is chasing me is getting closer and closer all the time, but it never really catches me. And I often dream of being shot, and I see blood, but it never hurts. I never experiencing it any pain. I dream of taking worldwide trips. For a while when I was a child, I dreamt of going to Disneyland quite often. Mm-hmm. I've never made it there to this day. Are themes like this common in dreams?
Yes, they are. A particularly common theme is falling. And this can, on taking the dream of falling, say, on the three levels of interpretation again, in the first place, in a dream of falling, you would ask, you know, is my stair carpet okay? Is the dream a warning that I must do something about my stair carpet to prevent a fall? Something very literal like that. Or check the guardrails on your balcony or whatever. However, if there's no meaning there, go to level two and ask yourself, what do I feel I am falling from in my life? For example, do I fear losing my job? Another example is the little boy who came home with a bad report card and dreamed of falling. Obviously, he felt he was falling in his parents' estimation. So a fall can be symbolic. And that is on level two, when it refers to a situation in your life. On level three, you then turn inwards again and ask, What am I falling from in my own estimation? Something I have done during the day has caused me to feel as though I'm falling in my dream. But each time, it has to be related to some specific situation during the day.
Are there any other recurring themes?
Yes, flying is a very common dream theme. And a flying dream, to be interpreted correctly, you have to get the feeling in the dream. If you're flying and feeling good, this is reflecting your feeling of having been very high during the day and having felt very good about something. If your flying dream has overtones of anxiety in it, it probably means that you have been trying to escape from something during the day and are anxious about it. Or you are trying to rise above something in your life and you do not feel you succeeding in doing it. Another common theme, of course, is our sexual dreams. People often ask me about this and they get very worried about their sex dreams because they think in some way they're oversexed or perverted or something like that. But considering the three levels again, what you would do is that you would ask yourself, supposing you dream sexually of somebody in your life at the moment, then the dream may be saying to you, do take this feeling seriously. Otherwise, if you keep it out of your consciousness, it could get you into trouble. Just become aware of what your feelings are. Then you can decide what to do about it. However, if you dream sexually of a film star or somebody who is not in your life at the time, then you have to ask yourself, what am I getting excited about at the moment? For instance, when John, my husband, and I were looking at new houses in Costa Rica, we would go to bed every night and have fabulous sex dreams, which would tell us about the houses we had looked at. We were using sexual metaphor. Does this house turn me on, get me excited? Some houses did not. There was the instance of the girl who dreamed of marrying an ugly, fat Frenchman when she was already married. What this dream was saying to her was that there was something ugly, cold, depressing, and a heavy trip in her life at the moment that she was espousing, that she was committing herself to. These are all metaphors, language of the dream. And it turned out to be her law course that she did not want to commit herself to for many years of her life. On level three with a sex dream, the dream means that you're coming together with two separate aspects of your own inner personality. In other words, you are getting yourself together. And in this type of dream, we talk about going to bed with another part of myself. So I tell people not to be worried about their sex dreams. Very often a sex dream is not literally sexual at all.
Do people dream often of being killed?
Mm-hmm.
And can one sort of experience dying through dreaming?
Yes.
And then this question has sort of a sub-question. Through our dreams, can we experience one of our past lives if you subscribe to reincarnation?
I don't subscribe to anything, only the dream. I have no philosophies, but a lot of people ask this question. What I answer about this is what Edgar Cayce said. He said, if you do have a dream about a past life, assuming that it really is about a past life, you still have to ask the question, why did this dream come to me tonight? Why did it come at this moment in time? There is something in my present life which is maybe reminding me of the past life, but it still has to be interpreted in terms of now and what is happening to me right now.
Have you known cases where people have gone back into their previous lives through the dreaming act?
No. We often dream of being in old-fashioned clothes or in an old-fashioned scene, or we're taken back to the Middle Ages or to the Civil War or something like that in a dream. This may have nothing whatsoever to do with reincarnation. For instance, if you dream of being taken back and taking part in the Civil War, what this usually means is that there is some sort of war going on in my life right now or inside me. And it has nothing to do with reincarnation at all.
It could also mean that you've been watching too much television.
No, no, you can't. If you're watching television or a movie or reading a book, you can use the symbols out of these and wind them into your dream. But these things in themselves can never initiate the drama of your dream. For instance, if you're watching a late night news or something and say a politician comes into your dream, don't just dismiss it. Oh, it's just the movie, it's just the news or something like that. You ask yourself why you picked up that symbol, took it into your dream, wove your own fantasy around it, and then ask yourself, what is this picture saying to me?
In your book, The Dream Game, you mentioned puns in dreams, P-U-N-S. Could you explain what you mean by this?
Puns, metaphors, plays on words, they're all the language of dreams. For instance, if you dream of a ship sailing across the water, your dream could be saying to you that there is somebody in your life at the moment who is like a ship that passes in the night. If you dream of a bridge over water, it could be saying, there is something in my life at the moment that is like a bridge over troubled waters. If you dream of a wolf in sheep's clothing, well, you know what that means. As for puns, many people don't believe in these until they start having them in their dreams, you know, until they start really noticing that they have these puns in dreams. For instance, there was this girl who wondered why she hadn't been going ahead and having a baby. She was into her 30s and she sort of wanted a baby, but she put it off and she couldn't really know why. Now, we have a system whereby we can put requests to dreams. At night we say, dreams, I know such and such a thing with my head, but you dreams down below, I wonder what you feel about a certain situation. So this girl asks her dreams, why am I not going ahead and having this baby? And she dreamed that she was in her house with a friend, and they opened her closet, and they looked inside, and her friend pointed out to Barbara that her jeans were very ragged and needed mending. Now, do you get the pun? Jeans. What this girl was feeling was that she had bad jeans. And this was like at a subconscious level. She was preventing herself from having the baby because deep down she believed she had bad jeans. But in the dream throws up a pair of jeans. How else can it make the point?
Yeah, that's incredible.
There was another lovely one about Bob Hope. Somebody dreamed of Bob Hope coming down the road on a pogo stick. And the meaning of that dream was that hope brings eternal.
All right. So this is how we can use dreams to help us solve problems. How about something as simple as something that you can't find, trying to find a lost object, a set of keys, a wallet, some money. Could a dream help you in this task?
Yes, it certainly can, and this works very often. In fact, dreams often throw up lost, you know, where a lost object is, or the answer to a solution without our even asking it. So this request method that we have, it focuses in on a problem. So if you do have a problem, then you can ask your dreams, can you help me solve this problem? Will you throw me a picture? Send me a picture tonight. Send me a dream which will help me in solving this problem or find the lost object or whatever. But you must have your pencil and paper by the bedside so that you can write down your dream immediately on waking. Otherwise, you will lose it.
I just recalled something very interesting that happened to a near relative of mine. She was lying in bed asleep, and she had a dream that her parents' home was on fire. Now, when she woke up, or perhaps while she was dreaming, she also smelled smoke. And she either called her parents or jumped in the car and sped to her parents' home, and indeed the house was on fire. And so we're getting into the area now of ESP and dreams. And have you heard of many cases like this? Do dreams often bring you ESP experiences?
I'm glad you brought up this question. Yes, dreams do bring up ESP, but actually no more than in waking life. In our experience, there is no more extrasensory perception in dreams than in waking. However, they sometimes appear to be more vivid in dreams. We take more notice of them, you know, extrasensory perception when it comes in dreams. Actually, we have a theory of ESP in dreams for which we really feel we deserve the Nobel Prize and no one has given it to us. And it's this. You see, we have so many anecdotes about extrasensory perception that we could go on forever. ESP occurs in dreams, in waking life. But it's no good just collecting more anecdotes. What we're interested in is why we have an extrasensory perception about one thing on one night and not all the other 100 things in our lives that we could have extrasensory perception about. So in brief, our theory is this, that when extrasensory perception really does occur in a dream, this is saying to the dreamer, this dream is very, very important to you. I want you to get the message. I am making a point. This situation is so urgent that I have put, you know, I have drawn on my ESP to make you look at this dream 100 times. The message is so important. You see, often extrasensory perception in itself is trivial. It really isn't terribly helpful. And so we feel that when we draw on our extrasensory perception, it's trying to make a very firm point to us to look at something in our lives.
All right, we can learn, I suppose, how to remember our dreams better, but can we learn how to dream better?
In the first place, you can learn to remember your dreams better by taking an interest in them and by suggesting to yourself before you go to sleep that I will awaken in the morning or during the night with a dream in mind and I will write it down. You can also stimulate dream recall by putting requests to dreams about problems or situations in your life. But as for dreaming better, there's only one way to dream better, and that is to get your life straight. Because dreams reflect our life in depth. And if you want to have high dreams, then you've got to get high in life. Because a dream is a reflection of what we do during the day. So I say get your life straight and you'll get good dreams.
So if your life isn't straight, is a nightmare the result?
If your life isn't straight, a nightmare is the result. In fact, a nightmare indicates a split in the personality. It's like one part of the personality, one part of me wants to do something, and another part of me doesn't want to do something. This is the basic cause of a nightmare. For instance, you mentioned dreams of being pursued and chased and killed. If they don't refer to something in our external life, like the feeling that I am being murdered at work, you know, or my work is overwhelming me, something like that, then it has to refer to something within the person, a war within the person, with one part of the personality pursuing another part, either to be heard, you know, say, listen to me, you are ignoring me, or to punish. But either way, it means that there is a split. We've split ourselves, and that results in nightmares.
Well, why do so many children have nightmares? I mean, it seems to be more of a natural occurrence in children than it is in adults. Is there a reason for this? Do they have split personalities?
I believe that children have nightmares because childhood is a nightmare. There's an awful lot of nonsense written about the glories and the happiness of childhood. But in my experience, childhood is no picnic. For instance, I mean, just the anxieties that go on at school, for instance, and the achievement ethic and the Puritan ethic. Children have to, they're sort of thrust into frameworks. You know, children are so ebullient, they're so emotional, they're such feeling creatures. And society, what we do with them, we try and cram them into something that they are not. And so in childhood we start molding them according to the image that we want them to be, not what they are. We do not help our children to be what they are, to grow naturally into what they can be, but we make them into what they are not. And it doesn't surprise me at all that they have nightmares.
Can nightmares, in fact, do us any good?
Yes, although a nightmare indicates a split in the personality, that two parts of ourselves are at war, as it were. When we interpret the dream, when we get the message out of it, what happens is a healing between these two parts. Now, a very interesting thing that can be done with a nightmare, it's rather difficult to get into, but with practice, you can. And that is, when you're in a nightmare, to try to become aware in the dream itself, in the nightmare itself, that this is a dream. I am in my own dream. It's like my consciousness observing another part of my own consciousness. So that the lion that is pursuing me, or the men with knives that are pursuing me, or the tidal wave that is about to overtake me, instead of running away or waking myself up, I can turn around to it and say, I am a dream body, and you're a dream tiger. And I can't be hurt, and you can't be hurt. So instead of running away, I'm going to sit down and have a chat with you. And then it's almost in the dream itself that a coming together of these two parts of the personality can take place. And it's really quite revealing when you do confront the threatening figures in your dream that so many of them turn out to be friendly. And all they're doing is trying to say, hey, stop, look, I'm having to come at you in this frightening way because I must get your attention. It's something we are running away from in our lives. And once we've figured out what that is, and with the help of the dream, then in our lives we can turn around and confront the threatening situation and say, hey, I'm not going to run away from this anymore. I'm going to confront it instead.
Could we possibly be devoured by that lion in our dreams?
Well, the amazing thing is, yes, you can be devoured by the lion. And what happens is that if you can just keep your control, as it were, you can just keep your cool while being devoured, you will, to your amazement, and if you can remain asleep, you will discover that when the lion has devoured you, you still exist. Which is almost the same as saying, like in waking life, there is a situation which I feel is going to kill me, it is going to devour me. Okay, let it go ahead. Let's see what happens. Might be something like losing my wife or losing my job. I think I shall die if this happens. But if it does happen, oh wow, here I am, still alive.
This is such a fascinating field that I imagine people who develop the art of analyzing their dreams and become very interested in it sort of can't wait to go to sleep at night so they can find out what new revelation they're going to have or what new insight into their personality. Do you find this sort of thing happen?
Absolutely. People who have had no interest in dreams and haven't been recalling dreams, all they need is one dream that they can understand and interpret and get a message from, and they just can't wait to get back into bed to have the next one. And this is quite the best thing for turning on to dreams. It's better, if you can, to discuss your dreams with someone else. It's nice if husband and wife can discuss dreams. I think it's marvelous if families can get together and discuss dreams with the children. And my dream is to see dream work carried on in schools, in churches, and in life generally, just to make dreams a part of waking life and not just something that happens to us when we go to sleep, then to be forgotten.
You must sometimes find it difficult to convince academicians or rather straight-minded people or that a dream counts all this much. People do say, as you said earlier, it's just a dream. Don't worry about it. Go back to bed. How do you try to convince these people? What sort of arguments do you get? How do you try to counteract these arguments?
Well, quite the best thing for getting people interested in dreams and for discovering that there is something in them, and anybody can sort of do this experiment, you just try saying to somebody, I had a dream about you last night. Even to the most confirmed skeptic, you see them go pale, and they won't let you go until you told them what you dreamed about them. So these people who say there's nothing in dreams don't really believe it. They know there's a lot in dreams. And the best way is to dream about somebody and share it, and then they're sure to have a dream back about you. This is what we call a dream duet, and it's like a level of communication going on between two people below the level of consciousness, and it can be very revealing.
Mm-hmm. May the amateur actually do themselves and perhaps other people harm by becoming a dream expert, in quotes.
No, nobody can do any harm by interpreting their own dreams. You can only do harm by interpreting other people's dreams and pushing your interpretation on them. But the point is that the dream is not an instruction as such. It is not something that comes to you to tell you what you should do. It is a message in picture language, that it is from the person, from the dreamer to the dreamer, and only he knows what it means. So either he can understand the dream and get a message from it which feels good and right to him, in which case it will move him forward in his life in a constructive way, or he can't get the message at all, in which case it doesn't matter, nothing lost.
Many celebrities or national leaders have had astrology consultants almost standing by like a physician. Do you know of any people that have dream consultants?
Well, I'm always hoping that the president will call me up one day and say, I had this dream, but he hasn't done it yet. But I do have people certainly call me up long distance when they have a worrying or troubling dream. And some of them are quite well-known people. In fact, one of them, I let the secret out, is a very well-known leader of the women's liberation, and she's really into dreams, and she'll call me up long distance from New York and say, hey, I want a consultation.
What other cultures consider dreams important and essential to their living? I do know that dreams are very important in the Bible, but have there been other cultures that consider dreams important, that interpret them? In your research, have you found this?
The Senoi tribe of Malaysia has always been interested in dreams, though I don't know how much they're doing now. But this tribe of just a few hundred people, they do have like dream breakfasts. Everyone gathers, everyone in the tribe gathers at breakfast to discuss their dreams. And particularly the children are encouraged to talk about and share their dreams. And this tribe is said to be the most democratic, the most non-violent tribe that, that we've known. However, I tend to think that this is because they're very small in numbers. I mean, if you considered like the United States, that has many more problems. But I would like to see small groups of people getting together in the way that the Senoi do to discuss their dreams. And I think that in sharing dreams, in getting to know the hidden feelings in ourselves, our feelings towards other people, feelings about ourselves, we would become a much more non-violent society. Because violence is so often the result of pent-up emotions and feelings that we don't express or that we're not aware of. And dreams make us aware of what's going on within us, so that we can then deal with other people and ourselves rationally.
Psychologist Dr. Anne Faraday, the author of Dream Power and The Dream Game. She was interviewed by Tom Regan of WMRA Harrisonburg, Virginia. Tom Regan saved the more controversial opinions for the second part of this Options, opinions on personal consciousness, evolution, and immortality. All coming up on part two of Options. Dream researcher Dr. Anne Faraday is married to Mr. John Wren Lewis. He's an internationally known writer on psychology, science, and religion. You may have seen some of his book reviews in Psychology Today. He's now co-director with Dr. Faraday of the Bragdon Mountain Center for Dream Research. When he spoke with Tom Regan, Tom wanted to find out first about John Wren Lewis's opinion of evolution, if indeed humans were getting any better.
I believe that Homo sapiens is perhaps becoming more cerebral or more complete or more godlike a being. And how would you react to this?
I think I would agree with more godlike. I would think that we probably can discern a movement, an evolutionary movement in the life of humanity. But I would have a little reservation about the word cerebral unless it were interpreted. I think I would agree with the word insofar as it does indicate that the thing that marks us out as a distinctive species is this magnificent mental brain setup that we have. And it is magnificent, and I think we've tapped about 10% of its potentialities so far. So that I think that we don't have to develop any larger heads or any larger brains or even non-physical mental capacities in order to get far more potential, far more godlike potential, if you like to use that term, than we now have. I think that we can get started in there by tapping the untapped potentialities of the brains we already have. Marilyn Ferguson puts it very well in her book, The Brain Revolution, that there's no need to go around looking for the super brain, we've got it already. The thing to do is to find out how to use it, and I think there are all sorts of developments both in science and in religious movements, of the popular religious movements today, which are aiming precisely in that direction. But why I jibbed at the word cerebral is that it carries in our culture the connotation of intellect as divorced from emotion. Now, one of the things that I've learned in my recent work with dreams, which I think I always knew, but the dream workers underlined it and made me much more aware of it, is that intellect without emotion is dead. Look at all the science fiction stories in which the villains are usually beings from outer space that are sort of computerized brains with no feelings. There's some deep thing in man which would regard that as evil. And in fact, I would be inclined to think that the tendency of man to go off on the purely intellectual kick to try and turn a felt insight into an intellectualized rule, which is the source of most evil in human life. It freezes things. William Blake, the extraordinary prophetic poet of a century ago, had this idea in which he spoke of evil as coming into the world through the freezing capacities of the mind. And you remember that Dante in the Inferno puts the devil not in a fiery place, but in an icy one. Freezing, which is the thing the intellect tends to do, is, I think, one of the ultimately evil things. What I see as the really high capacity in man, sweet reason, if you like to call it that, or spirit, if you like to call it that, is a fusion of the intellect and the emotions. I think emotion plays a very important part in reason, in man's own highest faculty. Now, for this reason, I think that whatever may happen to some future species that develops a still larger head or something like that, for us, for Homo sapiens, for you and me sitting here now, the way forward in our evolution, in our religious or spiritual evolution, consists in getting in touch with the marvelous capacities of a spiritual kind that we have right here in our own bodies. I think that the body has enormous mental and spiritual wisdom that is not normally tapped. The so-called animal nature has spiritual characteristics which we tend to ignore because we identify the spiritual with the intellectual. And so I see as a very important and hopeful sign that a lot of psychological and psychotherapeutic schools today are talking about the wisdom of the body. Now, for me, this is not something different from the wisdom of the mind. Stanley Kellerman just produced a book with a magnificent title, I wish I thought of it, called Your Body Speaks Its Mind. The body is a mind. The body is part of the mind. And the thing that one discovers again and again in dreams is that the wholeness of ourselves as spiritual beings comes when our mental energies get together with the emotional and so-called animal energies that run throughout the body. It is the whole psychophysical system which, to my mind, is the spiritual entity. And I think that the immediate task of Homo sapiens, whatever the long-term future may hold, is to get in touch with that wholeness of mind, body, and feeling and spirit. And to my mind, there's no better way of doing that than through dreams.
Isn't this what some of the writers like Emerson and Thoreau were talking about Emerson going out, communing with nature, becoming a transparent eyeball and floating above it all, and Thoreau wanting to get out to the Walden Pond to experience this oneness with nature.
I'm sure that this is what's involved there, yes. And I think what I feel about that is that while I can certainly go along with a desire of somebody like Thoreau for a simpler lifestyle than perhaps happens in cities, my feeling is that the really important thing is to get in touch with nature within ourselves. Now, a certain degree of communion with nature outside ourselves is a necessary thing for doing that. But I feel that there is a danger in the present back-to-nature movement, which is going along with a lot of the panic over ecological problems. Now, this is very real. I'm the last person to be unaware of the problems of pollution and the horror that you can get in life in big cities and so on. But I think that there is a danger here. It's the danger of an insight becoming an imperative and a dogma. I think that we can never, as Homo sapiens, as human beings, get away from the fact that the new capacities we have, the spiritual capacity, the religious capacity, the mental capacity, gives us responsibility. We have to take choices. And if you try to pass over those choices to anyone outside ourselves, a God or nature, then you're dodging the full impact, the full force of the new powers that man has. And I think at the moment, along with a perfectly valid desire to be more ecological, a perfectly valid wish to get away from perhaps some of the awfulness of cities into a simpler forest-type lifestyle, I think there goes a lot of romantic nonsense. We can't get away from the fact that the method by which animal nature copes with the population problem is by letting vast numbers of children die. I think we have to take the responsible decision that that sort of thing is not the way we want to do it. Now, once we take that decision, we then have to make decisions about how to change nature. And the responsibility is ours. And I don't think we can pass it up by inventing or imagining that there is something called nature with a capital N to which we should bow down and conform. I think it was Thoreau, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not absolutely sure who it was. He said that if nature has already found out a way to do something, it's best to leave it alone. Now, I think that is only partially true. I would say that if millions of years of evolution have discovered a way of organizing something, it's sensible not to mess about with it without using a hell of a lot of thought and a great deal of careful experimentation first. But you may still want to decide, and I think man being man, as being made in the image of God, if you like, has the responsibility of deciding whether to let things go on the way they have always been in nature, or whether we want to make changes. And I think the moment that man passes up that responsibility, he is at that moment committing the original sin. He is passing over responsibility outside himself. He is erecting an authority, and that's the beginning of trouble. So I see this danger in the modern back-to-nature movement, even though there's much very good in it.
You say that one way that we may become better in touch with ourselves is through dreams. And lately, you've been getting very much involved with dream psychology within the last few years. Why is that?
Well, it's partly because I am married to the world's leading dream expert, Dan Faraday, so that I have personal reasons for doing that. But the attraction between us was not in spite of the dream work or something different from it. It was also bound up with an interest in this subject. Since we've been working together, and we are currently working together, I've learned that dreams they are the royal road to greater self-understanding. And because they're the royal road to greater self-understanding for every individual human being, I think they are also the royal road to the discovery of the higher potentials within ourselves. They are the royal road both from self-understanding to self-transcendence, to rising to the higher levels of which mankind is capable. I found that this is true even of the most mundane dreams. There's a tendency of people who, in the consciousness movement, as it's called at the present time, who are interested in dreams, to want to concentrate on the big dreams that seem to bring revelations from a higher sphere, the big dreams with great themes in them that are mythological or whatever. And they get very bored with dreams of walking up the office stairs and going into an office that should have somebody in it and finding nobody there, that kind of thing, which of course is 90% of dreams. But in our work, we have discovered that if you take one of these so-called boring, mundane dreams and really see why the dreaming mind is bothering to throw it back to you in the night when you should have dealt with it during the day, you are, in fact, even in that small, mundane thing, coming together with a part of yourself that you'd neglected. And there is not only an important practical message for you about your life in the office, to take the example that I mentioned, there's also a snap as the two sides of yourself come together, in which there is quite literally an expansion of consciousness, a greater energy in consciousness. I know that when Anne and I have finished working on a dream, and we do it every day, as soon as we get up, being writers, we perhaps are more fortunately placed than most people to be able to do that, but I think everybody could do it if they tried. When we work on a dream, even one of these so-called mundane dreams, and it really comes out, and you say, that's, of course, that's what it means. There is both a sense of enormous aesthetic satisfaction of seeing your own production coming to life there. Secondly, your energies come together, and for an instant, you can turn around and you can see the environment much more clearly than you did before. It's as if you see everything around you in greater depth because you're now, for a moment, perceiving it with all your energy instead of with your energy split as it normally is in life. And so for this reason, I have come to believe that dreams, even the so-called boring, trivial dreams of every day, are the royal road to the expansion of consciousness. And for that reason, I believe that this could be perhaps the simplest way in which the churches might recover new life in the present situation would be by having, for example, dream work going on in them. Their dreams are always considered to be messages from God in the old days. I think they are, but they're messages from the God within man, not from some God out there who speaks in one dream and says, thou shalt do this, but not in all dreams. I think the true God is within us all. It's the creative energy within us all, the self-transcending energy within us all, the evolutionary energy within us all. And I think that this energy makes itself known through dreams every single night, and that the expansion of our consciousness is what it's all about, comes through working with dreams probably more clearly than in any other way.
What do you think about the current interest in death and dying? There seems to be a new book out on the subject every week. Is this a morbid fetish of some sort, a morbid trend?
It's a most important trend, in my judgment. I think that it's been said that death is the final taboo, and I believe that long after we've got over being worried about sexual taboos, we're going to come up against the problems of our fears and anxieties about death. Now, I believe that this is the basic human condition, that our new creative consciousness makes us aware of death as a tragedy. And I think there is no way around that other than really going into the nature of the death experience. And I think that this is why I'm welcoming the new trend. There's some very interesting work being done recently which suggests that it is the fear of death, the desire to avoid death, which actually is at the root of many of the authoritarian tendencies in society. That it's we somehow unconsciously believe that if only we throw ourselves wholeheartedly into the Communist Party or the United States or General Motors or the church or the family or something like that, that we can really somehow gain immortality for ourselves, which of course is a total illusion, but this is the unconscious motive for it. Now, the way to bring that motive into consciousness and make ourselves freer beings is to face head-on the fact of death. And my own belief is that the more we do face head-on the fact of death, the more we find that many of our fears of it are unreal. I think that there's a lot of evidence that the fear of death is something imposed on us by the way we're brought up. I think that and this kind of something that, again, we've learned through dream work, that time and again, when people ask their dreams what they think about death, they get the image of being punished in childhood. And I think that we have got this notion that death is somehow a punishment for disobedience, and that if we can get to the source of that notion in our own lives, we shall discover that there is in us a confidence of the human being's ability, the human animal's ability, to triumph over death. I don't know how it's going to happen, but I think it should be done.
Do you believe in life after death?
I believe that the human personality has a capacity to transcend the experience of bodily death, and that capacity can be realized. What I don't, the mystery is why we don't know it. This is why I don't know that I believe in any simple notion of immortality, that when we die we just pop off to somewhere else. I think it's more complicated than that. I don't know quite how it's more complicated than that. I think to try and go into it here would go into some pretty difficult notions. But my belief is that the so-called immortality principle, the notion that we can achieve a higher life beyond death by somehow pulling ourselves out of the body, is the greatest possible mistake. I think that in realizing the full capacities of the body, we realize that the body itself is not a lump of meat. The body itself is a marvelous principle of organization. We know that every atom in the body changes every 7 years anyway, so a body is not a lump of matter. A body is an organization. And I think that one of the things about some dreams is that they put you in touch with our own inner feeling of what that organization is. There are some very remarkable dreams known as out-of-the-body dreams, in which we experience the body as marvelously alive and well, as something separate from the body that's lying in the bed. Now, I don't think that's because there's an astral body or a soul that goes away when you sleep. I think what we're experiencing here is our own built-in capacities for organizing ourselves, a bodily system. We're experiencing our own capacity for being perfectly organized, full of vitality and health. Just how that capacity for organization is able to move beyond itself at the moment of death, I don't know. This is something I have to be agnostic about. I don't believe anybody knows. I don't think it just moves off to some other plane. I think that it maybe goes into suspension for a time, and then there's another phase of this life in which it comes. I don't know whether that's possible. Whether what we're all working towards in evolution is a perfect world in 1,000 years' time in which this kind of resurrection could take place, which would be another old Christian image. I don't know. All I'm saying is that I do believe that we have it in us, yes, to triumph over death. And I believe that with that simple realization of that capacity is right there when we overcome our own childish fears of death that derive from the way we were brought up and the fear that death is a punishment. And I think when we do that, we become freer beings. We're no longer able to be pushed around as much as we were. The ultimate threat is removed.
The opinions of science writer John Wren Lewis. Mr. Lewis is co-director with Dr. Faraday of the Ragged Mountain Center for Dream Research. He was interviewed by Tom Regan of public station WMRA in Harrisonburg, Virginia. And that concludes this edition of Options. This program was made possible with funds provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For Options, I'm Mike Waters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.